We are very relieved that we were able to locate them as quickly as we did with the coordination.
A seaplane crashes on Prince of Wales Island with 11 people on board. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 10th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski says she is reserving judgment on the president's Supreme Court nominee.
I am certainly going to defer on that until I have had an opportunity to review.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
11 people survived an airplane crash Tuesday morning on Prince of Wales Island, and as of this afternoon, they were back in Ketchikan. According to the U.S. Coast Guard, the plane crashed on Mount Jumbo on Prince of Wales, coming to rest about 2,000 feet up the mountain. Petty Officer Charlie Hengen says the Coast Guard dispatched two rescue helicopters out of Air Station Sitka, and they were joined by Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad personnel. Poor visibility delayed the rescue, but eventually crews were able to locate the downed plane.
One of the Jayhawk helicopter crews did hoist all 11 people from the crash site, so they then took them to a staging area, and at that staging area, there was room enough for the helicopter to land, plus about six or seven other helicopters, contracted out helicopters, were there with emergency medical personnel.
Hengen says those who needed medical attention were taken directly to Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center for treatment. Chris John of the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad said all the passengers were brought to Temsco helicopters in Ketchikan and were met by what he estimates were all the ambulances on the island. John says it's gratifying to be part of a plane crash rescue where everyone survives. Hengen, the Coast Guard, agrees.
We are very relieved that we were able to locate them as quickly as we did with the coordination, and we were thankful to have the Ketchikan Mountain Rescue Volunteers on standby as well. You know, being able to help out and being available to help as needed.
Hengen said in an earlier interview that the pilot had activated the craft's emergency locator, which helped in the rescue efforts. The pilot was also the one to call and report the accident. The downed plane was operated by Ketchikan-based Takwan Air. In an email, the company said it had suspended flights Tuesday and is cooperating with the National Transportation Safety Board and other authorities investigating the crash. After yesterday's announcement that President Trump is nominating Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, many liberals across the country are pinning their hopes on Senators Susan Collins of Maine or Alaska's Lisa Murkowski to derail the confirmation. Collins and Murkowski typically vote for abortion rights and are among the Republicans who most frequently vote against their party. But Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin says Murkowski is keeping her cards close to her vest on Kavanaugh.
On Monday night, outside the Supreme Court, an abortion rights crowd gathered to protest just after Trump made his selection. Murkowski says she's disappointed at all the interest groups and partisans who prejudged the nominee.
I'm a little annoyed that some of my colleagues, even before the president laid down Judge Kavanaugh's name, had already determined that they were going to vote against whomever.
Murkowski isn't making any such pronouncements, pro or con.
I've been asked already this morning by several different reporters, you know, what do you think? And I am certainly going to defer on that until I have had an opportunity to review.
She says she's going to base her decision on Kavanaugh's record, the rating the American Bar Association gives him, and the views of Alaskans.
I hope that Alaskans will weigh in, but I also hope that they will give it thoughtful consideration too, and not just a knee-jerk, you should support him because he's Trump's pick, or you should not support him because he's Trump's pick.
She says she'll also rely on what she learns in a face-to-face interview with Kavanaugh, which may be weeks away. For many Americans, this vote is all about the future of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 case that legalized abortion across the country. But it's generally accepted in Washington that you can't ask ask a judicial nominee how he'll vote on a challenge to Roe because a judge is supposed to consider the facts of each case. Murkowski says she abides by the rule.
If he's a good judge, he would say, I cannot predetermine an outcome. That's not my job.
Murkowski says her evaluation standards are rigorous and exacting. She was far more effusive when Trump announced his nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the High Court. In a statement right after Gorsuch was announced, Murkowski said she was pleased with the selection and commended Trump then on a strong nominee. Murkowski says she was able to say more then because she had more advance notice on Gorsuch.
The indicators were there very, very early that Gorsuch was going to be the nominee. And so I think there was a little more opportunity to just kind of process.
Here's another obvious difference. Gorsuch replaced Justice Antonin Scalia, who anchored the conservative wing of the court. But Kavanaugh would replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote on the bench. Murkowski says she valued Kennedy's moderating voice, and she said she'd be satisfied with a nominee in that mold.
And so the question is whether Kavanaugh, if he's confirmed, replaces him as that justice who's perhaps more in the middle. I don't know that he is. But that is something that I'm going to be looking at.
Actually, Kavanaugh is considered by most court watchers to be much further to the right than Kennedy. Among the other things Murkowski says she wants to know about Kavanaugh is whether he looks to precedent for clarity and what he considers settled law. Senator Dan Sullivan says Judge Kavanaugh is known for applying the Constitution as written, upholding the right to bear arms, and having a healthy skepticism of the powers of executive branch agencies, all pluses in Sullivan's book. And Sullivan says he knows Kavanaugh from when they both worked in the Bush administration. Sullivan didn't exactly say how he'd vote, but he very rarely votes against the Republican leadership, and he's given no indication that he would vote no on Kavanaugh. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The head of Alaska's largest labor federation says at this point, Governor Bill Walker would have most unions' support. And he wants Walker and former U.S. Senator Mark Begich to reach an agreement that would leave only one of them in the race for governor. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami about the race.
4 years ago, the AFL-CIO endorsed independent Governor Bill Walker, after Democratic candidate Byron Mallott joined Walker's ticket as the candidate for lieutenant governor. Based on what the Walker-Mallott administration has done since then, Federation President Vince Beltrami says the governor deserves re-election. The AFL-CIO will make an endorsement on August 24th, if two-thirds of its unions can agree.
If I had to make a bet, I would say that if we can get an endorsement, if we can get two-thirds, that it would be more for Governor Walker because folks believe that he's earned a re-election in our eyes. Now, that's just my opinion.
The AFL-CIO released poll results Monday that show Republican candidate Mike Dunleavy leading, with Walker and Democrat Mark Begich tied for second in a three-way race. But the poll says both Walker and Begich would defeat Dunleavy if there were only two major candidates. Beltrami says a two-person race would be best for workers.
I hope that there can be some consensus between the Walker and Begich camps on the way forward. And of course, that would mean, you know, potentially one of those candidates either stepping aside or coming to some kind of agreement like happened back in 2014.
Labor unions can play a big role in Alaska elections. The state has the fourth highest rate of union membership of any state at 18% of workers. Beltrami says he was a little disappointed and surprised that Begich entered the race. He supported Begich in all of his previous runs, but the union leader says this time it's confusing to voters.
I don't think it was the best calculation from our perspective for Mark to get in. He claims that there's a path to winning. I haven't seen that yet. I'm still looking forward to see if that bears out. But in general, it just kind of complicated the race a little bit more.
Walker says he appreciates what Beltrami had to say about the race.
I think we have walked the talk on where we are with labor. And it's a very significant part of that, of course, is the project labor agreement for a gas line.
Begich also is proud of his record on labor, and he says he was encouraged by the poll results. He notes he won a three-way race to become Anchorage mayor in 2003.
In a lot of ways, I think the next 7 or 8 weeks will really tell the story of who has the best chance of winning in November. I don't think it can be determined based on a moment in time.
Walker says he expects his campaign will talk with Begich's about narrowing the field.
I anticipate that there will be communications to a certain degree going forward. And I think that's probably a necessary piece to somewhat simplify the race to a two-way rather than a three-way.
Begich says it's too soon to predict how his campaign will interact with Walker's. He says that a week can be a lifetime in politics.
We're all competitive in this race. And what I know about Alaskans is they will pick the best candidate that represents Alaska's needs, not by party, not by who is spending the most money or who has certain special interest groups locked up.
The AFL-CIO will hear from candidates at a convention on August 23rd and could issue endorsements the next day. Beltrami says unions also will be active in legislative races. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a prison in Juneau is teaching a course in a supposedly dead language.
Anybody who's been to jail or has to deal with legal process, you see a lot of Latin words that a lot of people are not understanding.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
A shed and an outhouse. Those are the only structures that have burned in Alaska's wildfire season this summer so far, according to officials. Wildfires have burned just 270,000 acres in the state this year. That is far short of the 1.2 million acres that burn during a normal season.
In this press release that I'm just writing up, I used the word largely uneventful.
Tim Mowry is a spokesman for the State Forestry Division. It's one of several state and federal agencies responsible for fighting wildfires in Alaska. On Tuesday, those agencies said they're sending 100 of Alaska's wildland firefighters out of state. Five crews are flying to Idaho to be dispatched to fires around the western U.S. The main cause for this year's slow fire season? Mowry says there haven't been any long periods of hot, dry weather. There have still been 288 fires in Alaska this year, and they've burned 425 square miles, more than a third of the area of the state of Rhode Island. But most of those fires have been far, far away from densely populated areas. Two blazes are currently getting serious attention from firefighters. They're outside the small community of Chalkeetsik. That's about 170 miles northeast of Fairbanks. James Nathaniel is Chalkeetsik's tribal administrator.
Everybody was excited because you could actually see the smoke coming from the fire.
Lightning started the two fires in early July. Officials say the area where they're burning along the Yukon Flats is among the driest in the state, but firefighters are now making progress in getting them under control. The U.S. Coast Guard partnered with law enforcement agencies across the state to conduct a large-scale search for illegal activity on ferries in Washington State and Alaska. Between June 24th and July 2nd, according to a Coast Guard press release, they investigated ferries in Bellingham, Washington, Kodiak, and Ketchikan. Coast Guard members from across the state and the West Coast worked with local police and Alaska State Troopers to inspect over 1,500 passengers, 400 crew members, and 500 vehicles during that time. Their search included the use of drug-sniffing dogs. Lieutenant Commander Bernie Auth helped coordinate the operation. He said joint operations like this one help strengthen relationships between law enforcement agencies and encourage the sharing of resources and capabilities. He adds that a major goal is to deter and detect the transportation of illegal items via the sea.
Just with the Coast Guard being a maritime service, we know that's one of the ways that illegal activity can make its way up to the state and throughout the state. And so we want to do everything we can to eliminate that.
According to the press release, the operation included the seizure of 56 grams of heroin, an ounce of methamphetamines, and almost 2 pounds of non-commercial marijuana. Auth said this is the second operation the Coast Guard and their partners have completed together, and the last one was in March. Fewer summer chum salmon and king salmon swam up the Yukon River than expected this season. High water and debris made it tough to catch and count the salmon swimming by. At first, many hoped the king run was late and that restrictions would be lifted. But with more than 90% of the kings past the lower Yukon, data indicates that only around 165,000 king salmon made it past Pilot Station. That is much less than the low-end projection of 175,000. The summer chum numbers are also below the preseason forecast of 2.5 million. The in-season forecast is now around just 1.7 million fish. The data also indicates that the Yukon River King Run includes fewer older fish than was predicted. Every couple of years during salmon season, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game reports how many sockeye from each age class are returning to Bristol Bay. And how do they get those numbers? KDLG's Austin Fast followed a few employees around for a day to see just how it's done.
People oftentimes nickname this job as the pickers and the lickers, so I said I'm not a licker, I'm only a picker.
That's Hannah Hendrickson. She's talking about picking freshly caught sockeye salmon out of huge ice-filled crates so she can mark down their length, weight, and gender. The licker is her colleague Devin Lisak. She stands across the table at the Peter Pan Seafoods processing plant in Dillingham, snipping off bits of fins and plucking out fish scales. Here, she gives me some pointers for sticking them to thick cards to send to the lab over in King Salmon.
Grab the tweezers, and then you just give it a lick.
It's stuck on my tongue.
And then we take it, and that was fish number 4, so it goes on slot 4. And how did that taste?
It tasted flaky.
Flaky?
Flaky, and didn't really taste like much, actually.
No.
It tastes like chicken skin.
Yeah.
Kind of crispy.
Not bad.
A little bit? Yeah, give me some more.
It's an acquired taste.
The pair are part of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's seasonal crew, tasked with sampling 240 sockeye a day from each district in the bay. They also do 200 chums and 200 kings every week. They're looking at fish scales like tree rings to determine age. Wider sections indicate nutrient-rich summers, while narrower ones are the scarce winters. Jack Erickson, a research coordinator with Fish and Game and King Salmon, explains what the age classifications of 1-2 or 2-3 and so on mean.
We can, by looking at the scales, look at its growth pattern and then determine how many full years it spent in freshwater and how many years it spent in salt water. But when we say a 2-2, that means 2 full seasons at least in fresh and 2 full seasons in salt.
With a giant sockeye run of 51.3 million forecast for this year, should Bristol Bay fishermen care how old their salmon are? Erickson says, absolutely.
1-2s are smaller typically than 1-3s. They're a year longer in the salt water for growth. They're concerned about their markets as well. So, yeah, they should be looking at it as well. I think there's a lot of fishermen very savvy that are looking at the same information the biologists are when they look at that port molar test fishery, when they look at our age comps, when they look at our escapements. They're wondering the same thing and wanting to have instant access to it, just like the biologists here sitting in the King Salmon in Dillingham.
Providing all that fish data is messy work, with hours just as dependent on the tides as fishermen. During the school year, Hendrickson wrangles squirming 4-year-olds. She's now doing the same with fish that are just as slippery.
Sometimes we're doing an overnight sample that starts at 10 in the evening and goes till 3 in the morning. There's one time we got everything cleaned up and a tender from Igushit came in and we're like, we'll take him! So then we're here doing that stuff again.
Hendrickson is just 2 weeks into her first season sampling the Nushagak harvest. On the other hand, Lisak is an old pro in her 4th summer with Fish and Game.
Every day, struggle fighting with dead fish. And then when I get home, most of the time they're processing fish at the house, so it never ends.
So your whole life this time
yes,
of year
yes, this
is
time
fish.
Of the year is fish. I do get tired of eating fish and fish and fish.
Fish and Game has 1 catch sampler in Togiak and 4 in King Salmon, all sending data to the lab. Erickson says analyzing salmon genetics is just 1 tool in managing Bristol Bay's fishery.
It's a predictor. It doesn't always come in exactly as predicted. Matter of fact, they rarely do. Some come in large, some come in small. We don't take any specific one as a sign that something's bad or good. It just helps us kind of lead the direction of how we're going to manage.
Catch samplers will be meeting tenders at the dock every day across Bristol Bay until July 19th. In Dillingham, I'm Austin Fast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
Many prisons offer education classes for inmates looking to get their GEDs or take some college-level courses. At Juneau's Lemon Creek Correctional Center, though, a small group is studying Latin, a language that's been dead for centuries. KTOO's Adeline Baxter takes us inside the prison to meet the Latin scholars of Lemon Creek.
Visitors to Lemon Creek Correctional Center pass through three locked gates. You surrender your phone, keys, pretty much everything but your ID. Once you pass through the final door, you're locked in with 200 inmates.
I call them my captive audience.
Jim Hale has taught writing at Lemon Creek for about 4 years. Over time, he grew closer with some of his more dedicated students, and a few months ago, one of them approached him with an unusual request. Would he consider teaching Latin? Hale learned Latin years ago as a graduate student studying Renaissance literature, but he hesitated. His Latin was rusty, and why would anyone want to learn a dead language, let alone in prison?
The one thing about Latin is you'll see anybody who's been to jail or has to deal with legal process, you see a lot of Latin words a lot of people are not understanding.
That's Lowell Ford, the inmate who made the request. He's had enough experience with legal proceedings to recognize certain Latin phrases, but he says that's not why he asked Hale to teach the class. Since joining the writing class 4 years ago, Ford has worked hard to improve his style. But he's a perfectionist, constantly editing and revising his work, never quite feeling satisfied with it. He likes to write as concisely as possible, which makes choosing his words carefully very important.
With no grasp of Latin, then the grasp of English seems to be kind of fleeting and you lose where the word came from or what the word truly is supposed to mean.
In the writing classroom, Hale peppers his lectures with discussions of Latin etymology. He's always told his students that understanding the original meaning of the words you want to use is the only way to really get across what you want to say in writing. Knowing that, he said yes. The former professor and freelance writing instructor even bought the Latin textbooks out of pocket.
So it was a way of honoring our friendship, you know. And then he found other guys that wanted to do it.
The class meets weekly for an hour in the prison library. On the day I sit in, they're examining a poem about Dido, Queen of Carthage. Prison policy means I can't record the group, but I follow along as four men in faded yellow jumpsuits take turns translating lines of text into English. Ford says the vocabulary is particularly tricky. So much of English evolved from Latin, but so did the meaning of many words.
When you're memorizing the Latin original words, sometimes the English words try to superimpose themselves over the Latin origination words.
For instance, our words fact and fiction come from two Latin words that mean the same thing.
Ford says he spends more than an hour each night going over vocabulary and conjugation. He's been reading the Aeneid in his spare time.
It's like learning how to spell for a spelling bee. You take a list of words and you repeat them numerous times, and then you write them and you write them and you write them.
They don't spend much time on pronunciation. Latin hasn't been spoken as a native language for more than 1,000 years, after all. The goal is simply to understand the text they study. Hale says teaching the class forced him to revisit a subject he never thought he'd study again.
It's an old axiom that you never really learn a subject until you have to teach it, you know, and I feel like I'm learning Latin again with the guys, you know.
Ford has been at Lemon Creek for about 6 years. He's not due for release until 2020. He's 39 now, and he knows learning new languages will only get harder, but he's grateful for the opportunity.
It makes a section of time that would normally not have much value for me turn into something that can be positive.
The class may go on hiatus later this summer while Hale's out of town, but Ford said he plans to continue practicing alone and with his classmates. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
Residents of Larsen Bay on Kodiak Island are working to keep recycling alive for the population of 70 or so people. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche takes a look at some of their efforts to better deal with waste.
Postmaster and Larsen Bay Tribal Councilman Richard Henson opens a container that is doubling as a recycling center down the road from where the airport, post office, school, and city building are clustered together. Garbage bags cover one wall of the container.
That's probably maybe a month, 2 months. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was mostly beer cans. A lot of beer cans. Summertime.
Henson says the number of cans increases in the summer when lodges open and guides move in. As a member of the tribal council, he helps oversee funds for recycling in the village.
It was just years of watching our build, the cans and the garbage just build and build and build. And it's just not our community. It's statewide. There's a lot of rural villages out there that are dealing with a lot more serious issues than we are.
Larsen Bay was part of a federally funded project to remove roughly 2,600 tons of scrap metal from the Kodiak Archipelago communities between 2015 and 2016. They're working with the Indian General Assistance Program, or IGAP, to fund an ongoing recycling program. Henson says IGAP funds, about $36,000 this year, according to council staff, goes toward keeping the amount of trash and the number of aluminum cans under control. Henson says government funding is also how the community bought the multi-baler, which they purchased in 2012 for almost $18,000. It's set up at one end of the storage container. The machine can compact anything from 55-gallon drums to cardboard boxes.
There's a issue that we didn't foresee where, see the grooves back in here?
Yeah.
For some reason, when you're compacting the aluminum cans, because they're already crushed, that doesn't help either. They just fall apart.
He says the city mayor is working on making some modifications to the machine to fix that problem. Just outside the shipping container, there are several rows of large metal drums, which Henson says are now empty.
A lot of them come off of fishing vessels. You know, they haul whatever out here, you know, heating oil, whatever. Some of the gill net sites do that. Once they're empty, they just would sit around, and if nobody used them for anything, you see what happens to them. They just kind of start rusting and start leaking.
Henson points to a spot on the property where he says they hope to build a storage space. That way, they can process the cans, shrink wrap them, and store them neatly in a nearby facility, a step which he says could make it easier for barge companies to remove the recycling. He says Larsen Bay wants to use IGAP funds to construct the storage facility next year and strike a deal with a company to haul the recycling out of the village.
That was Kayla DeRoche from Larsen Bay. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. Weird reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Larsen Bay, Austin Fast in Dillingham, Johanna Urich, and last but not least, Nat Herz in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.